From the heart of the Forest City, Blackburn Media presents the Craig Needles Podcast, looking at the biggest stories in London and around the world and how they impact you. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
Thursday episode of the Craig Needles Podcast, and the provincial election rolls on, and I want to talk about some polling stuff or some... This is not a visual podcast, but I'm doing the air quotes polling stuff, depending on who you ask. I want to talk about some races that have been a little bit interesting. I want to talk about the fact that progressive conservatives continue to have a lead here. There's some jockeying between the NDP and the Liberals. So Suze Morrison, who as of right now is the member of provincial parliament for Toronto Centre, at the very least was when Parliament or Queen's Park went to dissolution and is not running again. She's been kind enough to join us here on the Craig Needles Podcast once again to analyze all this fun stuff. Hello, Suze. Thank you for this.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So let's first talk about some polling. And this has happened in a few ridings, including London North Centre. And there were some polls that were released saying, hey, you know what? The Liberals are ahead here. And then you kind of looked at some of the polls and there were some smaller sample sizes and they were phone polls. What was your reaction to that? Because I know that there was some pretty negative reaction in some political corners. What was your reaction to what you saw there? And I'll just say it from the Kate Graham campaign in London North Centre here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think overall, you know, I think what this is about is about strategic voting and the narrative around strategic voting. The only reason that a political party like a local campaign in London North Centre, for example, releases polling like that, is to essentially scare voters into coming over to their side, to say, we are the best chance to defeat the party you think is worse than us. And that's the only reason we can compellingly come up with for you to vote for us, because otherwise we're going to lose. I take a lot of issue with the narrative and the frame of strategic voting as a whole. And I will get into the polls themselves and what's kind of shady about them specifically. But strategic voting doesn't work. And there's actually some really interesting research that's been done out there that shows that actually, in a lot of cases, strategic voting tends to backfire and ends up electing. It confuses the electorate because you can't ever get everyone coordinated, all in rowing the boat in the right direction. And it often backfires. And so I think it's first and foremost a really disingenuous and dirty campaign tactic. And I think that any party that is trying to compel the electorate to vote from a place of fear is probably a party that doesn't deserve your vote. And I know that after 4 years of a regressive conservative government that has hurt a lot of people, people are eager to be progressive folks are eager to be rid of the conservatives. But I get really concerned when the narrative of strategic voting starts coming into play in an election, because strategic voting only ever serves to elect one party in the center. And I don't think that that's ever necessarily been in the best interest of folks that are, you know, basically scared into electing a party that stands for the status quo. But I think when we get into the actual specifics of the polls that we've seen floating around on Twitter, what I think I find most upsetting is they're not accurate information. It is an actual misinformation campaign that is, you know, internal polling with no transparency. I mean, you know, you can say that a third party contractor was hired to conduct polling on your behalf. We all do it. Every party has, you know, pollsters that we hire to run and conduct polls for us to give us information, you know, on different things, you know, how our leader is doing, you know, how the people respond to the party overall. You know, you might do specific polling in a riding for a candidate. You might do specific polling on, you know, checking how a message resonates, you know, as you're trying to fine tune, you know, how to talk to the electorate about a different issue. We all do polling. But, you know, there's no transparency to the public about where that list of phone numbers came from. You know, did that local campaign hand over a list of phone numbers from only their most favorable poll? in the one corner of the riding where they might have the highest concentration of voters? And were those the only people called? Maybe. Who knows? What were the questions that were asked? How were the questions framed? Were they without bias? You know, I heard one report from someone on Twitter who was saying they were called in one of these internal polls in one of the Ottawa ridings. And the question wasn't framed, you know, would you vote for X local candidate or Y local candidate? It was, would you vote for X local candidate or the other party and their leader?
Right. So,
you know, like it's, yeah, it, I think there's a lack of transparency and it's intentional misinformation. And that these polls have been crafted to intentionally scare the electorate. And I think it's a serious problem that, you know, needs to be addressed more broadly. This is not what makes for a good election.
Yeah, here's the thing. And I agree that, you know, polling data we should have. And polling data at the riding level is tough and sometimes it's going to fail to capture specific things within a riding. And certainly you're not going to get a lot of that publicly. A lot of the, you know, 338 and some of these websites that give you the percentage of each, you know, each party potentially winning a riding is looking at, you know, results from 4 years ago, province-wide polls and things along those lines. I'm more than willing to accept that those websites may miss some stuff from a riding to riding basis. That is completely reasonable. But if we're talking about polls that are that size, I just think that you have to look at them with some level of, you know, just raise your eyebrow a little bit. And, you know, you ask about methodology and plus minus and things along those lines, I think is an entirely reasonable thing to say.
Yeah, but the average voter
isn't going to do that. Yeah.
Hasn't taken a university level degree in stats.
Right.
And doesn't understand, you know, that a nice shiny graphically you know, appealing poll that is intentionally designed to stimulate a fear response from you, which is a very emotional place, right? It's saying, you know, the big bad conservative boogeymen are coming for you if you don't vote this way. You know, these polls are intentionally trying to say to the electorate, you know, the big bad conservative boogeymen, you know, are coming for you if you don't vote for us. And it relies on the fact that, you know, the average voter doesn't maybe have, you know, the background in, you know, research methodologies and stats, or how to navigate misinformation on the internet, which is a common problem in elections, to be able to distill that, you know, this may not be accurate information, but it's, you know, compelling an emotional response from people that then makes it harder to break through, you know, that sort of fact-checked barrier. If people believe something from an emotional place, it's harder to then counter that with accurate information.
There's anchoring bias and all this stuff. And I don't have a university degree in stats, but I've read about all these things. I understand all these things. So it's once that gets out there. Now, I don't think it was really picked up a lot by the mainstream media. And I still think that London North Centre is going to be a relatively close riding. And I don't think that anyone's up by 10 points, which is what that poll said. I still think London North Centre is going to be a relatively close riding. But yeah, it did definitely require some level of kind of cutting through what's going on here. So,
you know, we're seeing this narrative crop up in, you know, a number of ridings that are not even remote conservative possibilities in terms of electoral chances. And, you know, it's another thing that I find really, you know, sort of disingenuous about campaign strategies that want to lean into fear, where, you know, you might have a riding like mine here in Toronto Center,
right,
that never has elected a conservative, never will elected conservatives. You know, I joke at the door that there's all of six entire partisan conservatives in the riding. You know,
I'll use another one
it's never going to happen. But when what happens is you get, you know, your choice is always going to be between, you know, the Liberals and the NDP, maybe someday the Greens in a riding like Toronto Centre. And when you get Liberal campaigns that are coming in and scaring the electorate who don't understand how first past the post works in our multi-party system and saying, you know, if you don't vote Liberal, the Conservatives are going to win. When at a riding level in places like Toronto Centre or Toronto St. Paul's, you know, where Jill Andrew is facing that same strategic voting piece in her riding, again, where the Conservatives are not a threat. And then they use fake polling data to back it up. It's just, it's really, it is the worst kind of campaign when we get into this space.
I'll give you another example, and this is something that Mike Moffitt and I have talked about in the podcast, but Mike lives in Ottawa Centre. And he tweeted out that because of the Ontario Disability Support thing, which you and I talked about last time, that he was going to vote green. And he had all these people, both of the orange and red persuasion, as mentioned, saying, oh, if you do that, you're going to elect the Conservatives. And Mike's like, I live in a riding filled with public servants that are, in a lot of cases, unionized. The Conservatives are not winning in Ottawa Centre. Like, that has nothing to do with my vote. It's not going to happen. So it's not dissimilar from your riding that you're talking about right there. You know, same deal.
Exactly. Yeah. It is exactly that. And in fact, you know, in most cases, strategic voting backfires. It doesn't work.
Well,
you know,
I'll say what I said on Twitter. I think it was either yesterday or this morning. I'm pretty sympathetic to the argument of, hey, you know, if you want someone who traditionally supports the NDP or traditionally supports the Greens to support the Liberals, or the other way around, traditionally supports Liberals to support the NDP or whatever it is. Make the argument to them based on policy. Hey, here's what we're going to do that you like, as opposed to if you don't vote for us, you're a big jerk. It shouldn't be a guilt trip thing. You know what I mean? Like that's, and I feel like that's the way it's come off in some of these races.
Yeah. And I will say too, you know, for folks that are partisanly involved, you know, there gets to be a lot of historic bad blood that gets built up election over mm-hmm. these issues. You know, like this concept of strategic voting has been pushed by the Liberals for decades because it benefits them and it's a good electoral strategy and it works, so they use it again and again and again, and it has sort of seeped its way into electoral politics in Canada as a direct result of these, you know, campaigns. And you know what I will say is that my perfect example to counter this is 2018 and why I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of you know, sort of bickering going on, especially on Twitter, between folks that are partisan and have, you know, been partisanly connected in their lives, either as, you know, volunteers or staffers or electeds in whatever form, who remember how 2018 went down. And, you know, especially as New Democrats, when we sat there in 2018 and the wheels literally fell off the Liberal campaign bus and they were going down hard. And in an 11th hour last-ditch effort to save the handful of seats that they could, instead of, you know, swallowing their own strategic vote pill that they had peddled for years and years and years, the Liberal campaign turned and started attacking the NDP. And in the last weeks of that campaign, started pushing attack ads. And I remember the ad because it had my very good friend Fred Hahn in it, attacking the labor movement. And attacking the NDP and attacking workers in a massively funded ad campaign that cost us a handful of seats by a margin of a few hundred votes each that could have made the difference to stopping Ford from getting elected in 2018.
At very least could have made it a minority. I think it would have,
made it a minority.
It would have had to go a lot of things would have had to go, I think, the NDP's way for it to be, you know, a new Democrat government. But it could have been a different story if it didn't go that way. At the very least, we would know what would have happened if it didn't go that way.
Yeah. And sort of the thing that, you know, the partisans were saying at the time that, you know, never really got a lot of public traction was it was really clear. The Liberals knew that their path to rebuild was going to be easier positioning themselves against a conservative boogeyman government than it was to try and position themselves against a progressive NDP government that they were never going to be able to outleft. And they would have to position themselves again, center right, and, you know, appeal to a conservative base to make a comeback. And that path to come back would have been almost impossible. And so what I hate most about strategic voting is, you know, it's all fun and games until it's not in favor of the Liberals, and then it all goes out the window. And so there's a lot of bad blood, I think, between progressive partisans about how campaigns like 2018 went down, or federally against Harper, you know, and that history builds up. And I think it makes people particularly angry during campaigns when you're out there trying to get out there with a strong message about, you know, what you stand for, you know, in this public narrative about, you know, polling with shady polls starts, you know, taking over the airwaves. And it's infuriating.
So, yeah, I can understand why you'd feel that way. And to me, it just comes down to this. If you want voters that typically vote for someone else, talk them into it. Like, that's it. Like, and you know, go knock on doors, talk them into it. And so we'll use London North Centre as an example. If someone with the Graham campaign wants someone who voted for Terence Kernaghan in 2018 to vote for Kate this time, yeah, okay, that's fine. I think, go ahead, talk them into it. You know, but just hey, here's the policy that you might like or whatever it happens to be. Talk them into it. So, yep. Again, I still think this winds up relatively close. No one's up by 10 points. That poll says the Liberals are up by 10 points. Nobody's up by 10 points. So we'll see what winds up occurring here. But it's just, you know, we're a week out. And we're getting a silly season, I suppose, right?
It is silly season. I mean, you know, we're talking about the same week where we had the Liberals sending out some poor person dressed up in a chicken costume to dance around in front of PC campaign offices for not showing up to debates. You know, and when we're not campaigning on policy, when we're campaigning in chicken costumes, we have in fact reached the silliest season of this election, and I hate it.
I feel the same way. I want to ask you about the final week. When you won in 2018, did you in that final week, because you wind up winning by a relatively sizable margin and the polls were obviously, pardon me, sorry?
I won with 53% of the popular vote.
That's more than half the votes. That's pretty good in a system where there's a bunch of parties. So did you know you were going to win? Like, was there a point where you're like, okay, you know, election night, like, it'll be nice to sort of get it official. But did you know you were going to win? Because the polls were obviously getting real ugly for the Liberals and real good for you when you came to, like, you know, polls in the 416. Did you know you were going to win? Or was it sort of you had to wait till election night to know you were going to win thing?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I didn't even believe it was within the realm of possibility until about a week before the campaign, or a week before E-Day. When we launched that campaign in the beginning in 2018, I was a first-time candidate, an underdog in a Liberal stronghold seat. And I really honestly thought it was going to be my first run. I was going to learn so much. I was going to come back, build momentum, and it was going to be a 2 or 3 run go.
Right.
And around the halfway point of the campaign, we started picking up momentum, and I started to think, maybe we could do this. Maybe we could do this. And we started getting, you know, people coming in from other campaigns. So they were sort of, you know, shuffling the board as they started, I think, essentially realizing that, you know, the riding was in play. And that's usually a good signal as a local candidate when you start getting bodies coming in from other campaigns to help you on the ground with your ground game. It's a good signal that things are going right. And I think my team had a better understanding of that it was possible because they were looking at data that quite rightfully they were keeping from me. So, you know, you always want to keep your candidate working hard. And I think they were a little scared that if I thought we had it in the bag, that I wouldn't be hustling as hard at the doors as I was. I think they believed it a little bit more than I did. But honest to God, going into E-Day, I thought if we pulled it off, it was going to be by 100 votes.
It was by a little more than that.
Was a little more than that.
yeah, you wound up winning by a cool 11,000. So you know, it's a lot. And just for some context, Toronto Center is the reddest of the red ridings, really, traditionally.
Not anymore.
You currently hold it, but since 1997, this riding has been contested federally and provincially. Let me count: 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. That's federally, and then provincially, it's another. Oh, geez. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So 18 times. You're the first non-liberal to win it.
Yes.
So I can understand why there was some trepidation of, wait, is this really happening? But just the campaign got really, really ugly for the red team last time. And there it was. London North Centre is not dissimilar from that perspective. The Liberals have lost it twice since 2000. Once the disaster Ignatieff campaign in 2011. And then the disaster win campaign in 2018. So there are some ridings that are pretty traditionally Liberal that are held by New Democrats right now. And that seemed to be some of the space where we've seen some of this, hey, you got to vote Liberal here if you want to stop the Conservatives. Yeah. So, like, if you in London North Centre, the Conservatives could win. That's definitely on the table here. But that's where we've seen it, is the ridings where it went New Democrat for the first time in a long time 4 years ago. That's where we've seen a lot of it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, the Liberals know that their path to a comeback right now isn't through... You know, there's a handful of seats like London North Centre that, you know, could be a three-way toss-up. But overall, their central strategy is to take back NDP-held seats. They are not overwhelmingly targeting Conservative incumbents. They are targeting Jill Andrew. They are targeting Kristen Wong Tam in Toronto Centre, our 12-year veteran city councillor who stepped up to replace me. They are targeting folks like Marit Stiles and Butila Karpoche and Dolly Begum. Sorry to cut you off on the Dolly one.
That one they're targeting by having fundraisers with Tim Hudak.
Right?
Which just like, and here's the thing, say what you will about Tim Hudak, and I've got nothing but positive experience with Tim Hudak, but like,
oh, that's... same. I think he's a nice guy, actually. Yeah. I like Tim, if you're listening, like, I know I chirped you on Twitter, but like, I will say, when I announced that I wasn't running again, he sent me the single kindest message that anyone sent me that entire week.
Wow.
I have nothing against the man personally. Don't love the party that he led for a little bit.
It is funny though to try to take that ride and be like, oh, here's Tim Hudak. What does everyone think of this? Like that's funny. There's no way around it.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely funny. And it, you know, as New Democrats, it's sort of like, you know, right, Liberal Tory, same old story. Like, when are people gonna start believing it? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I get it. And here's the thing. Like I said, I've got nothing but positive experience with Tim Hudak. I think Tim Hudak's a really nice guy, and I'm glad that he sent you that message. That's nice of him to do. But it just from the political perspective, you're kind of looking at that, and you're like, okay, you're trying to get some conservative voters. I don't know. It's like we're into the last week, and this was in the final 10 days.
Silly season.
It's silly season, and silly stuff's happening.
Yeah.
The Conservatives continue to lead this race, and just about any poll would tell you that. So that being the case, why do you think that is? Why is the message not cutting through? Because I see the Conservatives leading in places that you wouldn't necessarily expect. Like they're way ahead in the 905 and things along those lines. Why do you think that's the case as you look at it? And I know your gut answer is going to be, well, everyone's wrong. But why do you think they're ahead right now, according to the polling data we have?
Yeah, you know, I've been trying to think about this for a bit. And, you know, as I've watched the campaign sort of unfold, you know, and now that I'm sort of a little bit removed from it and have a little bit of distance to watch it from not, you know, so in the middle of it, I think we're in a really unique situation where coming out of two incredibly difficult years of a pandemic, that the public itself en masse is dealing with trauma. Our communities are traumatized. There's no other way to say it. And when we, as human beings, are navigating our way through traumatic experiences, one of the first things that we start doing is forgetting things and being selective about our memory and having this sense of, you know, you don't want to focus on... You want to start focusing on, you know, the things that make you happy. And I think that overall across the province, people are trying to put the pandemic behind them, whether, you know, folks agree that it's past us or not. And I think that means, you know, the memory of the policies and the actions and the inactions the Conservative government over the last 2 years that cost thousands of lives across this province is not a memory that people are ready to sit and stare face to face with right now. And I think people are looking at, you know, the first summer that they are, you know, sitting in bars without masks on, and they don't care about the election. They just don't care. And, you know, maybe that sounds a little jaded, but I think it comes from a place of people have been traumatized for the last 2 years, and this election is not the thing that's on their radar.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. And I called it a sleepy election when I was chatting with Jonathan Scott earlier. And I think it's a sleepy election from the perspective that you mentioned, you know, we've been through a pandemic, and the pandemic really hasn't been a subject matter in this conversation of the campaign, which you can talk about whether that's on Ford, whether it's on the opposition, whether it's on the electorate. I think it's on everybody. But I think people are just like, okay, whatever, this is fine. I think it takes some effort and some gumption from voters to toss out a first term incumbent. And I just don't feel like that's here. And I don't feel like that's happening province wide right now. That's my analysis. Just maybe people don't have the gumption to do that right now just because they're worn out, you know?
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that there's this sense of, you know, people feeling like, okay, I made it through this global pandemic, I survived, things are fine because, you know, you personally made it through it. And, you know, it's been a tough few years, and it's hard to hold tight 4 years of hurt and harm, when all people want to do is look forward. But it's, you know, what's scary to me as a progressive is, you know, knowing how dangerous another 4 years, you know, of austerity and cuts is going to be as we look at exiting the pandemic, especially economically, coming out of this with, you know, inflation through the roof, with stagnant minimum wages, with a housing crisis, with a labor shortage, with supply chain issues. You know, we have a lot of really big picture economic puzzle pieces to put back together as we think about what recovery looks like. And I am really nervous about what 4 years of cuts and austerity is going to mean for that. When, you know, we should be focusing on things like addressing the housing crisis, investing in mental health care, as we now have, you know, an entire country of folks that have spent 2 years locked up in their apartments, with, you know, lacking social supports, you know, and navigating the trauma of a pandemic. We need to be talking about mental health supports. You know, there's really, really big, important policies that we need to be tackling. You know, and instead, you know, the real shame is, I think that, you know, overwhelmingly, the public conversation around this election is, you know, I don't have the mental capacity for this. kind of the sense that I get of where people are at and why people aren't engaging necessarily with the election like we saw in 2018.
Yeah, that's I think people that's are over entirely it. Fair. Yeah, people are over it. And here's the other thing. We just did a federal vote in October, and we're doing municipal vote in October again. Feels like that's a lot of elections. We have three elections in the space of 13 months here. And I would not want to be knocking on doors as a municipal candidate. I'll tell you that much right now at anywhere in this province, just because people are just going to be like, oh, someone else here that wants me to vote for them, go away. You know, I know that's not going to be what it's like, but, or at least not at every door, but that's the feeling that I think a lot of folks are going to have. And hey, I love politics. I love elections. This is fun for me, but for most of the population, it's like, oh, okay, are we really doing this again? And they don't understand, but they don't really care that it's three different levels of government. They just care, three elections. Are we doing this again? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, and that sentiment is so much worse in Toronto Centre, because don't forget, we had a federal by-election here.
Yes, that's true.
After the whole Bill Morneau wee scandal. So, you know, Toronto Centre has been in an election state. We've had three pandemic elections already. So, you know,
yeah,
the fatigue.
I didn't even think about that.
Feels real.
So yeah, from when was the time that the Morneau resignation by election happened? So when was that? 2019.
Yeah.
So from 2019 to 2022, there'll be four elections there.
Ugh. Yeah, because we had the provincial 2018, municipal 2018.
Right.
Federal, then the by-election, then the second federal election. Now we're back around to the provincial, and then
Municipal in October. Yeah, so it's like, that's six elections in 4 years. So, yeah. Not what you want. Not what you want. All right. Before we go, Suze, what are you watching the last week? What are you going to be keeping an eye on?
I think what I'll be keeping an eye on is, you know, the momentum piece. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the last week is always a big game changer because, people start just making decisions. You know, a lot of people sort of sit on the fence for the first, you know, 3-4 weeks of a campaign, and it's in the last, you know, 5-7 days, they start sort of, you know, locking in where they're going to sit. You know, we see this door knocking, you know, when you're out canvassing in the beginning of the campaign, you talk to a lot of undecided voters. You talk to people, you say, you know, how are you thinking about who you're going to vote for? And they'll say, I have no idea. I haven't even started thinking about it. And you know, around the last week of the campaign, people start saying, you know, I've decided, I've already voted, this is done. And I think one, we're going to see, you know, the legitimate polling that's out there start to really shift in the last week. We see major shifts in the last week, typically. And we also know, you know, the NDP tends to do a little bit better as we start to see some surging in the last weeks. It'll be interesting to see how that goes. But again, you know, with folks a little bit, I think, disconnected and tuned out from the campaign, you know, I don't know. Maybe people will be making up their minds
later than normal
in the election booth as they're marking their X's. But, you know, it's always interesting to see how things form up once people decide, you know, where they're going to sit, once the undecided voters start, you know, finding their home.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And there's been a battle, and we've kind of seen the polls shift a little bit back and forth between red and orange. I think there's going to be a little bit of battle there, and that will certainly be relevant here in London North Centre. I don't think that London West and London Fanshawe, we're going to see any sort of significant change here. And I've been saying this in the podcast for a while, but for there to be change in London West, I think that the Liberals needed to put up a little bit more of a fight against Peggy Sattler, and they really haven't done that. You know what I mean? Like that campaign. And Vanessa, I'm sure, is a very nice person. I really haven't met her. But it just hasn't been a well-financed campaign compared to some other Liberal campaigns, put it that way. So really in London, that's going to be the one that shifts. Whereas in Toronto, there's kind of a few that might be kind of up in the air between red and orange. So it's interesting.
I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to be the poor Liberal running against Peggy. She's legislative legend.
She got 55% 4 years ago. I don't know if she's going to crack that this time, but it'll be a big, you know, I would think it's going to be a big number. I meant to ask you about, before we wrap up, Chatham-Kent-Leamington, which I don't think is deciding it, the vote of very many people, except for perhaps people who live in Chatham-Kent-Leamington. But we talked about a little bit on the podcast last week. The Liberals put forward a new candidate there after having to change candidates. The new candidate used the signature papers that the previous candidate was going to use, which is clearly against the rules. That candidate is no longer the Liberal candidate. And Stephen Del Duca says, you know whose fault this is? Andrea Horvath, which, like, come on, like, just can we, like, I gotta ask, like, Stephen Del Duca's got to be serious here, like that, like, they screwed up and they need to own that. And the idea that, well, how dare the NDP, you know, look into whether someone's eligible to run for office, like that's hard for me to wrap my head around, to be honest.
You know, I'm going to tell you a really stupid story.
Okay.
Very quickly, I have a very angry little cat who I rescued from a forest once. She's borderline feral. And when she gets into fights with our other cat, she doesn't take it out on the cat. She walks over to the dog and she beats the dog up. Mm-hmm. And every time I watch this happen, it makes me chuckle. And I feel like this is exactly what Stephen Del Duca has just done, right? You know, like, his own campaign has made its own mistakes out of, I don't know what, laziness, out of lack of resources. You know, some poor staffer thought they could get away with it. Hey, we don't have the time, we don't have the resources, we're not organized enough, to get new signatures, just photocopy the old ones, send them off. Maybe we won't get caught. But then to come out and lash out at Andrea Horvath, like it's somehow her fault that your organization is in so much disarray that you can't even get nomination signatures organized to get your candidates legitimately on the ballot without using fraudulent measures. It's just like a feral cat going to beat up the dog when she's mad at something else. And I don't know. I find it mildly amusing, but also terrifying, because I think that any party that's positioning itself to say, you know, we're ready to govern a province that is the economic engine of a country and isn't organized enough to follow the very, very basic rules to getting candidates legitimately on ballots, I think raises some serious questions about, you know, how much integrity are they going to act with when they're in charge of the province, if they're given that opportunity again. You know, if something this small is done this unethically.
Yeah, it just,
what are they going to do when they're at the cabinet table?
I will say this. It does feel like that's something that, you know, 25 signatures. I don't know how long it took you to get your 25. What, an hour? Like, you know, you walk around.
You literally go door knocking. You can get most of, if you can't get 25 people to support your candidacy, you shouldn't be running.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like, they could have. They
25
just,
people.
The thing is, I'm sure they could have. They just didn't, you know?
Like, they just didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, it's a mistake. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. You know, we kind of hear about the mistakes of the Liberal campaign. We have to talk about the weirdo chicken stuff and this thing, which I don't think is necessarily moving the needle for a whole lot of folks. I don't think it's going to cost them a lot of votes, but it just it's not a good look. It's not a good look. Like, and just it's need like. It just, it's been a bit of a bumpy campaign. And I said it on Twitter, and I'll say it again. This version of the NDP campaign reminds me a bit of the 2014 NDP campaign. So it feels like it's been bumpy for everybody, you know?
It has been, right? And I mean, you know, in credit to, you know, all the parties, everyone's sort of out here, you know, a little bit rusty, I think, after the pandemic,
yeah.
Right? Like, we're all sort of trying to get back into the swing of, you know, campaigning, you know, when we've all been, you know, doing Zoom for 2 years, you know, which I think is probably a universally shared experience across all of the parties. But, you know, I think that, you know, if the Liberals are trying to legitimately position themselves as potential leaders of this province and, you know, they can't get 25 signatures to get a candidate nominated, they're continuing to stand by candidates that have said homophobic and sexist things because they didn't have the internal capacity or resources to properly vet their own candidates. You know, it just sort of speaks to a pattern of disorganization and internal dysfunction that, you know, I really hope that, you know, while each individual incident on its own, you know, can sort of get chalked up to, you know, is this going to move the needle? Is this going to move the needle? No, but I think it, you know, paints a picture of an organization that is in disarray and potentially raises concern about how that disorganization could affect the state of the province if those folks are elected to the cabinet table. I don't want disorganization and dysfunction in my cabinet ministers. And I think that that's...
Well, are you ever in the wrong province?
You know, honestly.
Sorry, but it's what we do here. Yeah.
But I'm an eternal optimist. I think we deserve better, and I have the hope.
We'll leave it there. Suze, thank you so much for this. Appreciate you you giving us a couple minutes here, as always.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
That's Suze Morrison here on the Craig Needles Podcast. She, of course, is the outgoing Member of Parliament for Toronto Centre. Joining us to talk about what's going on in the election. She, of course, is the outgoing New Democrat Member of Provincial Parliament for Toronto Centre. And this podcast is brought to you by Lexus of London. Lifestyle with a drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at Lexus of London. Luxury redefined. Choose yours today at the award-winning Lexus of London, 1065 Warrencliffe Road South, and online at lexusoflondon.com. Tomorrow on the Craig Needles Podcast, we are doing the Friday Roundtable. Going to be here with political insider Nathan Smith, former City Councilor Roger Carancy, and activist Selma Toba. Lots to chat about with that trio tomorrow. Hopefully you can tune in and download and do all that lovely stuff. Of course, you can find us at londonnewstoday.ca and classicrock981.com.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of Blackburn Media.